This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
From Brandeis University, welcome to Recall This Book, where we assemble scholars and writers from different disciplines to make sense of contemporary issues, problems, and events. Today, Elizabeth and I, hello, Elizabeth Ferry.
Hello.
Are delighted to speak with the brilliant Stanford English professor, Mark McGurl. Hello, Mark.
Good to be here.
It's great to have you. Who's Everything and Less, the novel in the age of Amazon, has just been published by Verso. So listen to us and then rush to your favorite bookstore to buy it. And if I say bricks and mortar bookstore with a poignant twang, you will know immediately how to place me within Mark's delightfully subtle and far-ranging categorization of the various responses that we citizens, consumers, readers, and I should also say the texts of those citizens, consumers, and readers can have to our era of Amazonification. So in his previous influential and wonderful book, The Program Era, Mark made waves by offering a system-centric approach to fiction on the post-war period in America, insisting that we look at the literal sites of production and also of accommodation for American fiction, those hundreds of writing programs that created their own ecosystem for certain forms, certain generic tendencies within literary fiction. And actually saying that, Mark, reminds me that you and Elizabeth and I obviously share this time at Hopkins, which was a very, very early one of those programs, I think, just after World War II.
Oh, yeah.
Returning vet programs. Yep. Yeah. So then he pivoted towards the Amazon era with a hugely influential, and I really influential even by non-English professor standards, 2017 article in MLQ, which was called Everything and Less, Fiction in the Amazon Era. And now comes this 300-page book that is maybe an unpacking or a next step analysis from that argument. So Mark, I have a zillion notes about how I see your argument proceeding. And I should say, we also have some companion texts to go along with it in this conversation. We have two older novels that directly thematize and explore the world of bookselling in its earlier pre-virtual forms. And as always, we are going to end but with recallable books, the book that if you enjoy this conversation, you may also want to dive into. But before all that, maybe I can ask you to just get the ball rolling by introducing or premising or otherwise presenting your argument about how you understand the Amazonification of the book business and the general state of the neoliberal internet economy. So small
sure.
question to get you started.
I think I can handle that.
Okay.
So the most basic link between the Amazonian literary sphere or ecology and neoliberalism more broadly is the concept of service and the service economy. So something like 80% of workers in the US now work in the service economy broadly defined, as opposed to the goods producing or agricultural economies. And as the crystallization of that reality, Amazon as a company has always defined itself by way of its obsession with providing good service. So it's no surprise then that its conception of the literary work is something that is as something that provides reliable service to readers. For Amazon, the reader is a customer. This being something like a total negation of the high modernist conception of the artist and the artwork as a product of wholly autonomous labor. And one of the most important ways that literature is enabled to provide good service to readers is by being organized into many distinct genres that line up with many distinct taste profiles. So as I put it in the book, for Amazon, all fiction is genre fiction, including literary fiction, which is simply another genre that some people really like. Those of us who are of a certain age will know that Amazon started as a bookstore, that was its first product, interestingly. And now it's so much more than that. I mean, the book part of Amazon is a tiny percentage of its overall business now, but I find that intriguing. I found that intriguing from the get-go. And it raised the question whether there hasn't always been a kind of literary or quasi-literary dimension to the whole enterprise, an epic dimension to the enterprise, insofar as it was sort of motivated by its first product, insofar as Jeff and Mackenzie Bezos are both readers and she is a novelist. So it sort of set my thinking along those lines. And then, as I'm sure you know, or had occasion to ponder, I mean, books are one of the first mass-produced commodities, right? One of the first machine-made things in multiples that get distributed. And so the book, in a way, has always had this interesting relation to industrial modernity.
Yeah. So I definitely want to go back the way you have raised that. We have had wonderful conversations in the past with Martin Puchner and Leah Price about sort of book history and the ways in which books are not just kind of representative and indicative, but in some ways kind of proleptic and causative agents at different cultural moments. So I definitely want to go back there. But can I just hold with the point you made about like the bookshop identity of Amazon being at the center of the concentric rings of its gradual pervasiveness to the economy? So how strong a claim is that about elective affinity? In other words, is it that it had to be a bookshop doing that because books and genres gave you actually an important paradigm, which then, you know, predicted and made easier the success of Amazon as it, you know, gave you different flavors of tapioca, different kinds of bicycle clamp, different kinds of cable? Those are just things I bought in the last week on Amazon. Is that a strong elective affinity, or is it more like just contingent? I mean, books are one object among others. It happened to be a good point of insertion for this sort of retail. How strong an argument?
Yeah. I mean, I would aim for something sort of in between those two claims. I mean, the very strong claim just sounds to me a little bit fanciful. That said, it wasn't purely arbitrary either. I think that, you know, Bezos, by most accounts, was intrigued by the internet and thought it should be in the 90s and thought it should be used for a new kind of business. And there's some evidence that he always was thinking about selling everything on the internet. He just looked around and saw that books have specific qualities that made them very convenient to start with. Most importantly, there are so many more books in existence than can possibly be housed in even a huge bookstore, right? And then very importantly, we already had the ISBN number system, so that books were rigorously trackable in a way. So it had, and then add on to that, they're relatively similar physical objects. They're relatively durable physical objects, so they're not too delicate, right? So when you bring together all of these elements, books made a heck of a lot of sense as the sort of thing to begin with. There are also all these practices intrinsic to the way Amazon does business that are quite peculiar and quite literary seeming. So like no PowerPoints are allowed at Amazon. You have to deliver your information in the form of a 6-page narrative that people can read before the meeting starts. So a commitment to textual linearity and argumentation mm-hmm. over and against the sort of visual. So you could look at that for instance. Yeah. If you want to introduce a new product at Amazon, I don't know if this is still true, but it used to be true, that you would present a futuristic press conference discussing the success of the product product that you, you know what I mean? So that there, it's so you can start to look sort of see like literary elements being sort of built into the fabric of the way the corporation does business. And then just most overarchingly, to go back to your thing about the hero, clearly Bezos, and this has been true since he was high school valedictorian talking about his dreams of us going to space, it's not just that he's a science fiction guy, it's also an epic science fiction guy with a little bit of an old fashioned conception of the hero, of the hero that will lead us where we need to go mm-hmm. as a people. Mm-hmm. And I think that Amazon has always had that epic heroic dimension.
And also leading as a kind of model for that, right? Like leading as the way that you're going to transcend your specificity and travel.
Yeah, at least initially, You read your way into the future.
Mm-hmm. So I want to tilt this conversation towards something that I'm basically going to sit back and listen to you guys talk about methodology, because Elizabeth, as an anthropologist, I think you have some thoughts about the methodological, you know, the sort of divides around how one writes a book like this, Mark. But can I start that by saying I really admired, and I would love to hear you say more about your notion that kind of buried within the genres that succeed within the Amazon universe of, you know, self-publishing, but just book distribution more generally, within those genres itself, you read basically a coded or implicit referentiality to the system itself. So I'm going to drop in on, because now I get to talk about something I've never talked about before, adult diaper baby fiction. No, that's not what it's called. Adult diaper porno fiction. What the hell is it?
What is it? It's adult baby diaper lover.
Adult baby diaper lover.
ABDL. Yeah.
Okay. ABDL.
Yes.
You Google it now. But and then except have a screen up when you Google it. Yeah. So
for work.
If I understand your argument, and this is what I want you to say more about, you're saying that in the kind of framework of adult baby diaper
lover.
Is a notion of kind of like it actually models the subservient, suckered, dependent consumer of Amazon products, and then the loving dominatrix giant mammary of Amazon, I guess. Is that tongue in cheek? I couldn't tell. Is your analysis tongue in cheek, or is it, do you think
only tongue in cheek to the extent that there one could multiply, I think, possibilities for this sort of allegory of Amazon's own business. It's just that's a very particularly direct and, I admit, kind of sort of funny one.
Yeah.
Because it's an image of a formerly alpha heroic male who eroticizes being dominated by a mother figure, mm-hmm. right? And provided with everything he needs rather than having to go out there and provide it for himself.
You know, a mother who looks a little like Jeff Bezos, in other words.
Basically, yeah. I mean, yeah. So I was just sort of interested in the erotica space in general, because it's the sort of wildest sort of affordance, to use that term, of the Amazon system. The things least likely to make it through any kind of like ordinary literary gatekeeper, but you can't keep the people from producing innumerable versions and permutations of their kink out there. And this was just, and I was sort of interested in that as a general phenomenon. And then I stumbled upon this stuff and I was like, wait a minute, that actually is uncanny. My first thought is, wow, this reverses 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah.
Perfectly. It's a perfect inversion of the model we're given by that super, super bestseller. But also it really kind of gets at least that element of Amazon in its relation to us as dependent consumers who, you know, sit immobilized as stuff is delivered to us, basically.
Mm-hmm. And all of our needs are met before.
All of our needs are met.
Yeah. So I'll just ask a tiny follow-up on that before the more, much more interesting question of, like, you know, talking to people versus reading books. So is it, do you feel like, is your insight that once you've understood this system, it's possible to go in and find, you know, the moments that resonate, the kind of fractals that embody the system as a whole? Or is the argument a little more agential than that, that you see people kind of working out the logic of the system that they are operating within by way of the stories they are telling?
Oh, well, God, probably not consciously.
Okay.
No. That seems far-fetched.
Yeah.
Spontaneously reproducing the way we all do.
Yeah.
We're all spontaneous reproducers of ideologies and ideologemes. And I think that that's what one is discovering. In this space, I have not been able to stop my own methodological commitments from being accretive, right? Mm-hmm. So that sort of multiplicity of approaches that you sense there, partly that's an artifact of the of my wanting to sort of like add up all of the things you can do to sort of read literary history rather than sort mm-hmm. of purify them in favor of one direction mm-hmm. or another. So a more positive account would be that because of certain kinds of theoretical models that fascinate me, complexity models, where you're sort of taught to think about things at different scales, right. And the way they relate to each other, the way the world is sometimes fractal in the sense that it's scale free. That something really is a perfect miniature of something right. larger.
Right.
But then in the social, that's not always the case. Sometimes mm-hmm. sometimes differences in scale produce real differences. Differences in quantity produce differences in quality. And so, you know, it's like a group of five people is not just a miniature version of a million
right.
people.
Right.
Right? And that's why our desire to have Jacinda Ardern as president of the United States is probably not going to work out very well.
Right.
Much as I want the world to be New Zealand, it's not going to be. So.
Yeah, exactly. And so in a lot of ways, what I'm doing in this book and also my previous couple books also, I think to some degree, is manifesting that fact of trying to perform multi-scalar analyses of things.
Right. I read it as sort of like, and the term fractal is also coming up in my brain, right? But in this sort of like, let us posit this as an example of that.
Yeah.
Or let us posit this as caused by that, or sort of as a, you know, synecdochic relationship of that, right? And sort of, but I like your word accretive, because it definitely, you know, it feels like this sort of like from this angle and then from this angle. And
Well, I mean, that goes back to the very initial gesture of the book, which mm-hmm. wants the reader, you know, to get interested in Amazon as a literary historical phenomenon mm-hmm. And goes with that, you know what I mean? For 200 plus pages, right? But which never, at least I'd like to think, never tries to pretend that there's something exclusive about this context
right.
that, you know what I mean? I think in terms of it being a big thought experiment. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's put Amazon at the center of things. Mm-hmm. And then what follows from that as an interpretive lens without ever sort of, it's so implausible to sort of say that there are not other profoundly important sort of ways to look at contemporary literary culture. There obviously are, mm-hmm. And so it tries to be forthrightly constructivist in that sense. Mm-hmm. It's like yes, I mean, I do want to claim that, you know, it's not crazy to say that Amazon is the most interesting thing that's happened materially to literary history in the past 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
the gauntlet I throw down in the book is to say, can you point to something that's happened inside a novel since 2007 that is as consequential as the arrival of the Kindle in 2007?
So that sounds like a great time to loop back to our historical context. And I think each of you guys chose a book that looks at the book trade at an earlier moment. And I don't know, Mark, since yours historically is a little bit earlier, do you want to start off with the Morley book?
Sure. Well, there's this book. First, I want to give a sort of shout out to a graduate student in my department named Jessica Jordan, who's working on this genre, which books about books, which turns out to be much larger than you might have imagined. I knew about this book from researching my first book, which is about the turn of the century, literary professionalism, but she reminded me of it working with her. So, but it's called Parnassus on Wheels. It's by Christopher Morley. It's just kind of, I'm not going to make a case for it as a great novel. In some ways it's quite slight, but pretty entertaining and sort of drops you in. And I think that our next novel does the same, sort of drops you into a moment of true book oriented literary idealism. The idea, so the plot is that a woman is living with her older brother on a farm. And then he happens to becomes a famous writer by writing essays on the joys of living on a farm. And she's, you know, happy for him, but she's really, really bored. And then she gets this opportunity to buy a mobile book wagon, a little mobile bookstore, which she then rides around the countryside. And then the substance of the novel are the adventure, the picaresque adventure she has as a bookseller woman. This is another sort of through line that we could look at. So finds her way into the book business in this way. It's an opportunity for her, but it always goes hand in hand with the sort of opportunities to bring enlightenment to the countryside of America. It's sort of an interesting sort of moment a representation of book selling as, you know, it's pre-Amazonian in the sense that books are being brought to you. So mm-hmm. It has that delivery of books aspect. On the other hand, they're being delivered by horse and wagon. So it's a little bit different, but nonetheless has this, you know, deep humanist enlightenment faith.
Actually, Mark, can I ask you more in terms of the humanist enlightenment? Can I pick up a really awesome point you made that I didn't want to get lost, which had to do with the ISBN number system? Uh-huh. And I guess it's the way I'm going to frame it, Elizabeth, you might have a different way in, is to think about historically the different models we have for commodities. And, you know, I wrote a book about portable property in which the default commodity.
Right, of course, yes.
In which I did think about books as commodities, but I thought about fungibility. And obviously, if you're selling flour, there's not a lot of, I never really thought about this with Amazon, but there's no real advantage to my buying flour from like somebody who's got 1,000 warehouses, because you don't need 9 million ISBN numbers for flour. You just need flour. And books are particularized commodities. So in other words, that doesn't make them not commodities. But an aspect of their commodification is that each one has this particularity. Like that's what makes them valuable as commodities. Do you want to say more about that?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just an interesting fact about the book as commodity. In a sense, there's a radical similarity of one book to another physically. I mean, we know there's variety in the physical shape of books, but like, you know, there's also a radical similarity of the codex form from one, you know, from one version to another. And then any given title, of course, all of those books, at least in the same edition, will be completely similar.
Right.
But then books, the book market as a whole is characterized by, you know, being occupied by, I don't know, 5 million different things.
There's something specifically, I don't know, humanized about the commodity, because the commodity is a book, you know, that it has this special je ne sais quoi, because every book is different from every other in a way that somebody
absolutely
doesn't have that.
Sure. And as you can learn from Laura Miller and other historians of the book trade, it's remarkable how long a kind of pride in it being a bad business lasted.
Yeah.
It really took the beginnings of corporatization in the 60s and 70s and 80s for that mentality to sort of drain away. It was the sort of New York City version of it was that it was a gentlemanly business.
Yeah.
Right? Very much removed from the rough and tumble of other sectors of the market because imbued with this seriousness of purpose. And the sort of, you know, backcountry version of that is reflected in the Morley novel.
Yeah, that's great. So Elizabeth, do you want to connect that to Penelope Fitzgerald?
Yeah, and I was just going to say that, that sort of idea of book selling as a terrible business is related to the notion that it's sort of an anti-market.
Yes.
You know, it's sort of a sphere that is supposed to be free from the market, right?
Right.
And therefore, which also relates to this question. I mean, a lot of the commodities that we think of as being these sort of commodities that are based on distinctiveness rather than similarity or fungibility also kind of play with that idea, right?
Mm.
That sort of notion that they're, a work of art or whatever that's like somehow not against the market. So anyways, not a few things of what you said about the Morley could be described about the bookshop. And that's, a sort of, a lady bookseller who's kind of going into this sort of hostile environment. It's not sort of traveling in, mobilely by mobile bookshop, but it's sort of in this, English kind of small town. And we had a discussion offline about kind of whether we thought it was one of the better Fitzgerald's books. and I don't think it is, but I do like it a lot. And I like its kind of like, its non-triumphal quality.
Right? Yes.
Like it is not about conquering the minds of rural Britain in order to get them to appreciate her, dictuitiveness or whatever, right?
She loses, right?
She loses,
it's all totally. A big failure,
And that seems very Fitzgeraldy in a way. It's kind of like very humorously unforgiving.
As a massive fan of Fitzgerald, can I just put a plug in here that it's 1978. I think it's her second novel. And in 1977, she published her book, The Knox Brothers. Do you guys know that? Is like the portrait of her four great uncles, I suppose. And one of them was the editor of Punch. So I actually think there's an older literary historical tradition that she's part of. Like, in other words, she is very much in the family business of, buying newsprint at 2 cents a pound and selling it at 5 cents a pound. I mean, like, she's thought about different modes of dissemination. And of course, she has this wonderful book about the BBC, Human Voices.
Human Voices, yeah.
Which is, again, about medium specificity.
So, yeah.
Yes.
Another possibly important detail is that the bookshop is a historical novel. I mean, not at great distance. It takes place in the late 50s.
Yeah.
But it's a 78 novel. And so the book is very charmingly a book about a failed project of enlightenment of the small town. But that sort of success might be added in, as it were, historically from 78 as a clearly much more liberalized moment.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back on that conservative.
Lolita, right? About the book Lolita, trying to sell the book Lolita.
Yeah.
So can I turn back, Elizabeth? You made a really good point about the kind of not unsaleable commodities, but commodities that are saleable precisely because they mark their distinction from mere commodification. Is there something to be said about the aura or the kind of metonymical association of like cool prestige objects that get sold in a bookstore? And so, Mark, I'm sort of thinking about Amazon here, like opening out from its beginnings as a bookstore to so much more. But also, Elizabeth, just your comment made me think about all those you know, hipster t-shirts that I have bought for $28 at a bookstore, or the like cool Canadian bacon chocolate bar that, do you know what I mean? Like there's like a whole set of items, which I've heard in some bookstores are like the main seller, you know.
Or the the little meditation manual that you get.
Totally. Yeah, but forget the manual, you know, like the little mindfulness token that you can buy at the, you know, which is, so what is it about those things? Because they are erraticized by being in a bookshop. And Mark, it's so great that you name checked our colleague, Laura Miller at Brandeis, because I actually don't really know her work on this. I knew that she worked on it, but I'm going to go check it out.
Well, now. I mean, the book of hers I've read most recently is Reluctant Capitalists.
Yeah.
So, which makes the argument right there.
That's great. I mean, I'm so sorry we didn't have her in this conversation. That would be great. See how wonderful.
It's a great. It's a,
yeah.
Wicked smart, really good book.
Yeah.
You just taught me the word erraticized.
Erraticized, thank you. Like aural and it's things that make you do fun things with your mouth. Yeah, but that notion, right? Reluctant capital. That's a great way of thinking about it. So yeah, Mark. I mean, do you have thoughts about that? Historical genealogy of the book trade.
I think that to some degree Amazon disconnects from that, in the sense that, I mean, except insofar as it's opening physical bookstores of its own, it's disconnected from that, and that feature of especially, well, no, not just independent bookstores, all bookstores have lots of tchotchkes. Yeah. That are marketed to the people who go into bookstores. So there's a kind of a class profiling going on in that stuff to some degree. But that also maybe has something to do with profit margins, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, as you say. Amazon's a little bit different in that because it's at least the online part is virtualized, you don't get that kind of associative. Certainly not that you're not representing yourself and behaving visibly as a certain kind of person with a certain kind of taste profile. Mm-hmm. So I think Amazon's a little bit more of the massified version of that. Mm-hmm. Although for sure, I mean, the funny thing about it is that it just expands the number of commodities that you might buy at the same time that you buy a book.
It presumably has algorithms that are then, you know, pushing up certain things based on
Does either of you know much about the history of the kind of culture wars around public libraries in America, Mark? I feel like that might be something that's kind of in your bailiwick. No, but I mean, just the thing I was thinking about is, you know, with the rise of the Carnegie system, around 1900, more or less, and then the professional librarians that Melville Dewey trained, you get that question of whether the library is going to be a space of massification or a space of cultural prestige, you know, because there was lots of, I'm going to call it, good popular literature that in a library pre-Carnegie, the library could just hold that stuff. So in a way, historically, the arrow goes the other way, that 19th century libraries were not ashamed to have the things that people wanted to read, but then the library became a prestigious, erraticized space. And then you had to not have 10 copies of the latest quote trash. Instead, you had to have, you know, Harry Beecher Stowe and Herman Melville and all those other folks. So,
yeah, I don't personally know that history well enough to comment on it. I mean, I because I'm obsessed with what I am obsessed by, there's the question of ebooks and the library.
Yeah.
Just to go to a highly specific, highly contemporary debate being had about whether you can take out an ebook and what the property status of those are going to be at libraries. Because that is one way to acquire an ebook, is to get it from a library.
So I actually think this is a good moment for us to turn to the question of recallable books. So as loyal listeners know, these are books that if you enjoy the conversation today, and who would not, these are other books you might want to look at that kind of fall into the same bailiwick. So Mark, as our guest, I'll turn to you first and ask if you have one to suggest.
Sure. My recallable book is relatively recent in that it's 40 years old. And it's a book by Walter Tevis, who also wrote Queen's Gambit, which was just made into a, he also wrote The Man Who Fell to Earth.
Love that book,
So a really sort of super interesting science fiction-ish writer.
Yeah.
But the book I wanted to point at, and it's a truly interesting book, really, really worth reading. And it's called Mockingbird. And it's a post-apocalyptic novel, came out in, I think, 1980. And in this post-apocalyptic future, it's an illiterate future. Books re-enter the world in a very, very fascinating way in this novel. And it, despite its sort of dystopian vibe, which is sort of continuous with Fahrenheit 451, mm-hmm. the Ray Bradbury sort of dystopia, mm-hmm. Anti-literary dystopia that people are living in, it's in that sort of sub-tradition of the books about books.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a really fascinating novel. It's got a small cast of characters. It's very inflected by existentialism. Mm. One of the main characters is a humanoid robot who, for reasons that are, like, they ask why this is true, but he's embodied as an African-American guy, and he's the new dean of NYU. So there are all sorts of, and he's immortal, and this is a problem for him. This is the existentialist thing, because he's a robot. And then there's the two other main characters, and one of them is, they both rediscover books and what books mean. And that makes it sound a little way more corny than the book actually is. It's an amazingly well-executed novel, and anyone who's interested in this kind of thing, I strongly recommend it.
Okay, that's great. Thanks, Mark. And thanks for mentioning Fahrenheit 451 in passing. That's obviously a great one to think about. In fact, Bradbury in general, I feel like from The Illustrated Man on, Martian Chronicles, he does have this kind of love-hate relationship with the notion of a kind of prestige cultural canon embodied in books.
Yep.
You know, even Edgar Allan Poe keeps coming back in Bradbury. Yep. So it's a good way of thinking about it. So I will I'll go way back, and I'm gonna do what Elizabeth usually does, which is recommend a Trollope novel, and it's The Warden, which is, you know, a great Trollope novel in and of itself, but it's also his first novel, and it's really interesting because he's definitely still feeling his oats and feeling his way generically into how he identifies the kind of work that he does. So Mark, one of the reasons I asked you the question about adult baby diaper,
adult baby diaper love fiction
is I was interested in that level of generic consciousness. And in The Warden, the generic consciousness is very high. Uh-huh. So he situates the novel in opposition to a newspaper called The Jupiter, which is the bad version of the Times of London. But he also trots out Thomas Carlyle as Dr. Pessimus Anticant, who is another example of how not to write fiction. And then he also invokes Mr. Popular Sentiment, who is Charles Dickens, who's another example of how not to do it. So he's locating himself within the triangle of, you know, bad other iterations of what a realist novel might be. So I think it's a good one to think with.
Most of which are on the grounds of sort of catering too much to the public, right?
Yes and no. Actually, I think his critique of The Jupiter is that it treats itself like a god. Like it is lowest common denominator, it's true, but it also establishes a prestigious distance above its audience, whereas he's saying his kind of novel lives at the same level
it's shaping popular opinion. It's sense propounding. Of godliness is it's sort
exactly.
of like the critter of, you know.
Yeah. And Pessimus Anticant is like, you guys are all doomed anyway. So it's not so much a god as it is like Lucifer or something. Just like I forsake you. And somehow Trollope is the only one who gets to be with you, but nonetheless preserve, I don't know, some sort of prestigious intellectual detachment at the same time.
Right.
Which Mr. Popular Sentiment gives up.
Center of honor or something.
Yeah, something like that. That's right. Yeah. Anyway, cool. Well, thank you, Mark. This has been an awesome conversation. We really appreciate your coming and taking the time.
It's been really fun. Really, really fun.
So let me just say quickly that Recall This Book is sponsored by Brandeis and the Mandel Humanities Center. Sound editing is by Naomi Cohen. Website design and social media by Miranda Puri of the English Department. And Elizabeth and I are very eager to hear your comments, criticisms, and thoughts on today's discussion and on the book trade generally. If you enjoyed today's episode, you'll likely enjoy, I think, our earlier related conversations with Martin Puchner, that's RTB6, and with Leah Price, RTB46, about the tangled history of books as objects, as media, and as scalable commodities. So I think our discussion about scale really will resonate for us. Please write a review and rate us on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. So from all of us here at RTB, thanks for listening.